As many as 900 people died in the Mediterranean yesterday, at least in part because they were economic migrants. It's an economic issue for the European Union as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 20th of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. This has been, as you've been hearing today, a tragic 24 hours in the Mediterranean Sea. There is no final count yet of exactly how many people drowned in yesterday's sinking of that migrant ship, and there were at least two other rescues going on over there today. What is clear is that there's no let-up in sight for people trying to get out of where they are, and also no clear answer from the European Union as to what they might do about it. Chris Morris is the BBC's European correspondent. We got him in Brussels, Belgium today. Chris, it's good to speak with you.
Thanks very much.
We are hearing, it seems, more and more of these incidents of unseaworthy ships, of hundreds of people dying. Why do you suppose that is?
I think that it's a problem that's been building for years, and the numbers have continued to rise, partly because of chronic instability in parts of the Middle East, in Libya, in Syria, and the economic opportunity that many others have. They're not all political refugees. Many of them are economic migrants. Right. And so it's hardly surprising that people are willing to take grave risks to try and get a better life for themselves and their families. And the political response so far has simply been inadequate. Will this now be a tipping point? It might be, but I think the response is going to have to be a response which unfolds over a period of years, if not decades, rather than days and weeks.
The European operation, such as it is right now, does seem to be more of a policing operation than it is a humanitarian rescue operation. Do you suppose that'll change with this weekend's events? Is the mindset going to change?
I think some things will change. How much is tough to say. For example, one thing that's being proposed now by the European Commission is to double the funding for search and rescue operations and recovery operations of boats that get into trouble. A year ago, that figure was three times higher than it was now. So even if you double it, it's still going to be lower than it was a year ago. So there's still, I think, a huge question mark about whether European countries can cope with the tide of people that's still going to come. The other thing they've said they're going to do, and we've heard this again from many leaders today, is really focus on cracking down on the smuggling gangs who are at the heart of many of these networks. But I think there's also a problem with that, and that is this, that even if you took out all of the smuggling networks, you wouldn't take away the demand of those tens and hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to reach Europe. The smugglers, however venal they are responding to that demand.
The irony of the southern Italian states being left alone in some ways to deal with this by the rest of the European Union is that a lot of these migrants, they want to get to Germany, they want to get to France, they want to get to the places where the jobs are.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they arrive in those southern countries, but they want to move north. I mean, the countries which receive the most migrants and asylum applications every year, I think, are roughly in order of the top four: Germany, France, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. But you're right, that's where the jobs are. That's where many of the opportunities are. London, in particular, is a magnet because it's, I guess, Europe's genuinely international city. It's a place where many people from many countries have friends or relatives or somebody from the village. You've said, if you manage to get here, I'll give you a place where you can kip on the floor and my cousin will give you a job in his bakery. Those kind of stories I've heard time and again covering these migration patterns over the last couple of years. And so people will continue to keep coming. And that's why the other part of this strategy is to have much greater cooperation with countries of origin and transit, the countries in sub-Saharan Africa where many of these people are coming from, but also the countries where migrant boats are setting sail from. So these are very dangerous and very volatile times.
The emergency meeting in Luxembourg on Thursday between European Union ministers, what, if anything, do you actually expect to come out of that?
Well, the meeting on Thursday is actually going to be not ministers, but European Union leaders. And I think it's a sign, the fact that heads of government are going to take the time to come together to discuss one specific issue. I think the message is that the size of the problem now, it means that it can no longer be avoided. You can no longer pass the buck and point the finger of blame somewhere else. The EU's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, said this morning, this is a union, the European Union, based on values of human rights and human dignity, and it's simply unacceptable for us in the 21st century to continue turning a blind eye.
The BBC's Chris Morris, the European correspondent for them, we got him in Brussels. Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Greece, as Chris and I touched on, is on the front lines of this disaster and of its own internal economic drama as well. There is going to be yet another meeting this week geared to yet more conversations about bailouts and paybacks. Stay tuned is about the best thing to say about that. It was China, in part, that cheered the gang on Wall Street today. New rules to help economic growth over there stay at the pace to which we have all become, well, I guess, accustomed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Well, that's it. The digital world is officially all mobile now. You want to know how I know? Google said so. That's how I know. The company is going to make a big change to its mobile search algorithm tomorrow by giving priority to websites that it classifies as mobile-friendly. That is, sites that have been specifically designed to work on smaller smartphone screens. Businesses that don't have mobile-friendly sites aren't completely out of luck, but close. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
Monica Elkington is a lawyer in Alaska. She does criminal defense and family law, and she has a website, which is how many of her clients find her.
About half of them come through the website and half of them come through referrals.
When Elkington heard about Google's plans to change its mobile search algorithm, she typed her web address into the test site that Google set up, and it told her that her site, which had been designed for a desktop, was not mobile friendly. There's a lot of text that's too small to read. So as of tomorrow, when people do a Google search from their phone for a lawyer in Anchorage, Elkington's ranking will go down.
To get a responsive website, my design team quoted me about $1,200. And that was about the cost to create my website in the first place.
Elkington has decided not to spend the $1,200. She's going to wait and see how the new algorithm affects her business before making any changes. But that's a risk that a lot of other businesses can't afford to take. Brendan Howard runs a small business web design company.
Typically, search engine optimization or search engine rankings are going to be your biggest influx of customers online, at least. People, whenever they're researching a product or service or they're looking to buy, they typically go to Google first.
But it's not just small businesses that have not adapted. Large companies, including Nintendo, Versace, and Kroger, all have sites that Google has classified as not mobile-friendly.
So if the site is a sales site, for example, then it has a lot of back-end functionality, and it would cost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to rebuild the whole thing.
Google announced the changes on February 26th to give websites time to redesign. Its announcement warned that this change will have a significant impact in our search results. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Here's today's boy-you-gotta-love-capitalism moment. Halliburton, one of this country's biggest oilfield services companies, lost more than $500 million in the first quarter of its fiscal year, yet shares were up today. That's in part because the company has cut 9,000 jobs in the past 6 months as oil prices have fallen, with the promise of more cuts likely to come. Those layoffs have hit hardest in places like North Dakota, the second biggest oil-producing state in this country, where Marketplace's Annie Baxter has been spending some time recently talking to workers on the losing end of the oil trade.
It's early evening in Williston, the capital of North Dakota's oil patch, and the oil freight running through these parts is making the Amtrak train late again. Among the passengers killing time waiting in the train station is a Halliburton worker named Scott Nyberg. He's headed to Minnesota.
I'm going to go spend some time with my wife and her parents and go see my parents for a few days.
After that, he'll do some training with Halliburton in Texas. Yes, the same Halliburton that's been cutting 10% of its workforce. Nyberg is well aware. Some of his buddies just got laid off. So did Nyberg's younger brother.
So it was, yeah, kind of unnerving, I guess. Made you a little bit nervous to wonder if you were next.
Nyberg says he'd be even more nervous if Halliburton weren't investing so much in his training. And unlike his brother, he's got a mechanical engineering degree. He hopes that'll help him stick around through the company's cost-cutting.
There's still work to be had, and those who can endure and make those cuts and not just go belly up will make it through, and then when it turns around, there'll be a mad rush to get people to come back.
In the meantime, another guy waiting at the train station, Kevin Groner, isn't rushing in.
It's hard when you come out to an area like this to say, oh, it's all going to be great and fine.
Groner came to Williston looking for a job. It was one stop on a scouting trip by train. But then he heard about layoffs around town, so he won't bring his girlfriend, Billy Joe, out for a look. They both need jobs.
I don't think I could grab Billy Joe here and make it great and fine.
Instead, Groner says he'll keep going farther west. In North Dakota's oil patch, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Is it a song that is a great song? It's just on the wrong playlist. Or have we given the playlist the wrong title so that we're not setting up someone's expectations?
Sure, an algorithm can generate a playlist for you, but wouldn't you rather have the human touch? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, no Monday blues for Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial's up 208 points, 1.1%, 18,034 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ rallied 62 points, 1.2%, finished at 49.94. The S&P 500 up 19 points, 0.9%, 2,100 even. Morgan Stanley reported its best quarter since the financial crisis. Revenue from bond and stock trading helped its bottom line. The company's stock ticked up 0.5% today. 0.5% is another way to say that, I suppose. Thank you to Iron Man, Spider-Man, and Optimus Prime. That's what Toy Maker Hasbro is saying today. Sales from toys based on characters from Marvel Comics and the Transformers movies lifted the company's revenue. The stock kicked up 12% today, and you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee holds a hearing on opportunities and challenges for agriculture trade with Cuba. What do all those dates stamped on food products mean? That's one of the topics on the agenda at the National Food Policy Conference. It starts tomorrow. And Jane Eyre author Charlotte Bronte was born 199 years ago on April 21st, 1816. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's festivities on Wall Street aside, this has been a pretty meh year for stocks overall. You break out of healthcare, though, and it's a whole different ballgame. The S&P index that tracks healthcare companies is up more than 7% year-to-date. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains why that is.
For some, explaining the sector's success is easy.
Simply stated, the Affordable Care Act.
Wunderlich Securities analyst Art Hogan says the government has poured billions into making sure people are insured. That, he says, means more customers. And more customers floats everybody's boat.
So whether you're running a hospital or you're running a doctor practice or you're running a pharmaceutical company, there is more access to your product. Therefore, profitability in the healthcare sector is going to go up with that.
Obamacare, though, is just one source of success. Biotech firms are on fire, with Hogan pointing out those companies are up 18% this year, more than doubling the total sector. Bloomberg Intelligence healthcare analyst Astika Gunawardena says firms are developing innovative products.
We're going through a phase where the science has become very, very good these days that, you know, you're almost, I don't want to say almost guaranteed clinical success, but your chance of clinical success is really high.
Gunawardena says, take, for example, Gilead's highly effective hepatitis C treatment, Sovaldi, which has generated more than $10 billion in revenue. A wonderful drug, but at $1,000 a pill, it's expensive. It's an issue, he says, with big biotech blockbuster drugs.
The question that comes to mind here is, okay, so you're having all these great drugs come out. Who's going to pay for them?
That's the big risk with these hot biotech firms. As a rule, Gunawardena says, pricing questions send stock prices fluttering. And as companies deliver more powerful drugs, these questions will only intensify. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
There was an acquisition announced today that, in all seriousness, involves a former fire breather, various and assorted acrobats and contortionists, and a group of high-flying private equity firms. Cirque du Soleil, the No Animals' highly stylized performance troupes with shows around the world, is being sold for $1.5 billion Canadian. That's a little over $1.2 billion American dollars. Ian Austin covers all things Canada for the New York Times. We've got him on the line from Ottawa. Ian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai.
Why is this happening? What's the driver?
Well, the driver dates back to the great economic collapse of 2008. Guy Laliberté, the founder of the circus at that time, kind of pulled back to literally go off in space in a Soyuz capsule. But they'd struck a deal with two Dubai investment groups that didn't pan out for international expansion. A series of setbacks then befell them. Obviously, the economy, their show in Japan got whacked by the tsunami. And for the first time in their history, which was at the 25-year point then, they had shows that fizzled out. People didn't come and see them, or shows that cost more to put on than the box office brought in.
And he has now regrouped, and there are Chinese investors interested, there are American investors interested. It's interesting that this is going to go private equity, because, of course, private equity has this connotation of, you know, we strip it down, we get our money back out of it, and then we flip it around. What are they going to do to make their money back?
Laliberté came back in 2012. They immediately took out 400 employees, which was more than 10% of the workforce. And he said today they cut $100 million in costs. What these guys need, and I think what this is ultimately about, is to find a successful way into the Chinese market to take advantage of the growing middle class there.
What do they cut? Do they cut like safety nets and contortionists? Or how do you, I mean, they're a circus and you got to do certain things.
They killed shows that were only marginally profitable. I think that was their first big step. This thing sort of grew out of nothing. I mean, Liberté was a fire breather and a busker who played an accordion.
Literally fire breather, right? I mean, he was like a sidewalk guy. Yeah.
Literally a guy who sort of started out of it as a kind of hippie commune circus that was pay anything you want, and then lucked into some government money thanks to the 450th anniversary of the founding of New France, which became Quebec. Their shows, as anyone who's seen them knows, are very elaborate, not just in terms of choreography and circus craft, but also technologically. And they were developing three new shows a year. So they just had no cost controls, no nothing. They took a lot of costs out of it and put more discipline that had been largely absent before.
You mentioned Quebec. Guy Laliberté is, he's an icon, I think it's fair to say, in Quebec. Is there a, not a nationalistic, but a sense of homegrown pride about this thing that might be affecting the deal?
Oh, completely. Quebec is a pretty small place, and he's literally one of 6 billionaires who live in the province. So he's hyper, hyper sensitive. Plus, they're a big employer in Quebec. I mean, they've got 4,000 employees, 1,700 of them work in Montreal. There's a circus school that's come out of this. So they had to deal with a lot of delicate optics, and the way they ultimately dealt with it was bringing in Quebec's pension and investment fund as a sort of minority investor, and they laid out a lot of commitments to keep the head office and the creative center in Montreal, although we know how much those commitments are ultimately worth in some cases.
You must have seen this troupe in action up there, yeah?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they revolutionized circus. I mean, I saw them the first time, I guess, about 2 years after they began. They adopted the kind of acrobatic model that had been popular in Asia and Europe and really updated it, both with technology, but also by making it into an artistic performance.
Ian Austin, we got him up in Ottawa. He covers Canada for the New York Times, talking about Cirque du Soleil. Mr. Austin, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. You're welcome.
If you're of a certain age, you'll remember making mixtapes for a friend or perhaps a crush. Or maybe if you're not yet of that age, you made mixed CDs. But you get the idea. Songs you pick that you hope might mean something to the person on the receiving end of the thing. The more modern equivalent, I suppose, is the playlist. You can still craft it yourself, of course, with some quick dragging and dropping. But an increasing number of music streaming sites want you to outsource your playmaking responsibilities to them. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at the surprisingly complicated ways companies try to string music together, which it turns out is a mix of man and machine working together.
The last playlist Peter Asbill made for his music site Songza is called Grown Men Making Grown Men Cry.
Don't look so sad.
He says people spend more time than ever with earbuds in their ears. So his goal is to give listeners the perfect soundtrack for specific moments of their lives.
But life
goes on.
Companies like Spotify, Pandora, Google all won in on those listening hours. Google actually bought Songza last summer, and Asbel now oversees editorial on Google's Play Music team. About half a dozen of them are meeting in a conference room with a giant spreadsheet projected on the wall.
But let's jump into some stations. So these are all of the playlists that we have, all the stations within the working out experience right now.
There are 86 different playlists just for working out. 86. And here's something sort of surprising in this digital age, especially for Google. These playlists are made and revised by human beings, real live people, with the help of lots of data. Asbel and his team meet regularly to try and figure out what's working and why. He pulls up a spreadsheet with data for the performance-enhancing pop playlist, which includes this Miley Cyrus song. This playlist gets selected a lot, which is good, but its satisfaction score is just okay.
Sort of a proprietary score that is a mix of skips and thumbs up and thumbs down and listening time on the playlist, but gives us a sense of how happy people are once they've clicked, once they're listening, right?
So the team looks at songs to drop or add to make it better. An obvious place to start is the worst performing song. Honey by Mariah Carey. It's a bit slow. Lady Gaga, on the other hand, is killing it. Kenny Loggins, not so much. It's fast enough, but...
Do people want to go from Lady Gaga to Kenny Loggins? Like, that's a kind of human decision. They're like, no, that doesn't really make a lot of sense.
So Kenny and Mariah, you're probably out, along with Britney's I'm a Slave for You. The group thinks that should be moved to their sexy, sweaty workout list. But why is this human touch necessary in 2015? Why not take this data and let machines and algorithms do the work? Google's Play Music does use algorithms when people want to pick an artist or a song and have the site suggest similar music. But Asbel says playlists made by human beings can be creative or funny or unique to a specific situation, activity, or feeling. And for that, it takes people.
It always requires further investigation. If it's a new song, is it too early so that not enough people know about it and like it yet? And will it do better over time? Is it a song that is a great song? It's just on the wrong playlist. Or have we given the playlist the wrong title so that we're not setting up someone's expectations for what they hear on the other end?
On the other hand, Pandora, an early entry into music streaming, also relies on people, but in a very different way. It too uses algorithms to create playlists based off of a song or artist that the listener chooses. But unlike Google, which has machines analyze those songs, Pandora uses people. Steve Hogan is Pandora's music operations manager.
It really takes a human, you know, for example, a human can listen to a song and pick out there's a trumpet, there's an acoustic bass. This is something the human ear can do in a fraction of a second.
A team of 30 people, most of them active musicians, analyze 10,000 songs a month. For each one, they tag 200 to 400 traits that the algorithms then use to do their work, answering questions like, how much does the electric guitar dominate this song?
That would be on a 5-point scale. Beyond that, we want to know how much distortion effect is on that guitar on a 5-point scale. What is that guitar doing? How much of it is strummed rhythm guitar?
Back at Google, in an empty conference room after that playlist meeting ended, I told Peter Asbel that the whole process reminded me of that corner of the party in high school. Those music nerds arguing about the merits of a song I'd never heard of, at a level where I'd quite frankly never be able to participate. I sort of meant it as a compliment, or at least not an insult, but he looked a bit wounded.
If we were that corner of the party, then we wouldn't care at all about the data about how these things are actually performing for our users.
He said those high school guys were set in their opinions. They'd never change their minds about a song. Glancing back over his shoulder at the spreadsheets and all that data, Asbel said he and his team are constantly changing theirs. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, filed under the tab Digital Killed the Radio Star, and I guess it goes along sort of with Tracy's feature just there. Norway, that is the whole country, says it is going to turn off its FM radio spectrum in 2017. You know why already, I'm sure. The Ministry of Culture there says going all ones and zeros will, and this is a quote, give listeners access to more diverse and pluralistic radio content and enjoy better sound quality and new functionality, end of quote. Also, and not to be disregarded, it's going to save the government there $25 million a year. All right, we got to go. Quite the spiffy day on Wall Street today. The Dow up 208 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ up 62 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 climbed 19 points, 0.9%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.